Unit 4, Part 1. Instructions about a test. Okay, let me tell you about what'll happen when you take the listening test next week. First of all, once you're all sitting down and everything, the supervisor, the person in charge, will switch on the tape recorder and you'll hear some general information. It'll tell you, for example, that you are going to hear each part of the test twice, and that you will have time before each part to look through the questions and time after each part to think about your answers. After that, the supervisor stops the tape recorder and hands out the question papers and the answer sheets. That's the time to ask questions if you have any, or to mention any problems, because you can't speak during the actual test. So if you have a problem hearing the tape recorder, for example, or if your pen has run out, you should say so now. I'd take a spare pen with me if I were you. But don't take any correcting fluid. You know that white stuff you use to correct mistakes? You're not allowed to use that. Okay. Once you've got your question paper, write your name and your examination index number on it clearly, and sign the answer sheet in the space at the top. Now, when the test begins, make sure you use the time before each part to look through the questions. That's really valuable, as I keep telling you. The question paper has instructions for each part, and these are also repeated on the tape. You'll probably find it easiest to write your answers on the question paper first, though you don't need to. You can write directly to the answer sheet if you prefer. At the end, you get 5 minutes to transfer your answers from the question paper to the answer sheet. Make sure you copy them carefully. There may be 3 parts to the test, or there may be 4. It varies. But the instructions at the beginning will tell you. Anyway, the test generally takes between 30 and 40 minutes in all, although it will probably seem to go like a flash. There's a total of 20 marks for the listening test, by the way. And Cambridge says that on average, people who pass get about 12 marks. I'm sure you can manage that. Remember that the listening and speaking parts of the exam are important. They make up 1/3 of the marks for the whole exam. Any questions?
Part 2. Are you a good language learner? The topic I'd like to deal with this morning is what makes a good language learner. This is an eternal problem, and one to which there's no real solution. I would, however, like you to think about the situation of learners outside the classroom, because in many ways it would be true to say that there are more people in the world who speak a foreign language or a second language who didn't learn it in a classroom than there are who did. And I think this awareness of the success of out-of-classroom learning provides us with a key to how in-classroom learning can be successful. Let us look, then, at the characteristics of a good language learner. I think motivation is certainly going to be very high on our list. Obviously, there are different kinds of motivation. There is what we call instrumental motivation. This is the kind of motivation which, in theory, persuades a school pupil to learn a language in order to pass an examination. It's external motivation, something which is imposed on the learner. The opposite of this is integrative motivation, the kind of motivation which gets an immigrant in a country or someone who's married to a speaker of another language to master the tongue much more rapidly than someone learning in a classroom. Arguably, most people possess mixed motivation, although it would appear from research that integrative motivation does give much better results, certainly as far as speed of learning goes. Personality is obviously another major factor to be borne in mind. Not necessarily. I'm not necessarily saying that you need, how shall I say? extroverts to learn a foreign language, but someone who has the confidence to make mistakes is always going to learn much more quickly than someone who is afraid to experiment. Intelligence isn't a factor, I feel, in language learning. I would prefer to use the term learning skills. Learning skills are those abilities which make one person progress at a much faster speed than the others. They include having a good ear, efficient revision, being able to monitor your own speech, suitable organization of learning generally. However, if we go back to our starting point, which was the much greater number of speakers of languages who have learnt outside classrooms, I think it gives us the key to what I believe is the most important factor, and that's independence. A learner who frees him or herself from the tyranny of the teacher and the classroom, and who makes use of 24 hours a day for learning, who, in a word, accepts responsibility for learning, is always going to be not just a good language learner, but the best. Conversely, someone who won't accept this responsibility is always going to remain at what we call a plateau. They've failed to make progress and blame their teachers. In reality, it is themselves that they should blame.
Part 3. Differences in North American English. The North American continent, consisting of the United States and Canada, covers an area of approximately 7,300,000 square miles. Within this area live about 266 million people, 240 million in the United States, and 25.5 million in Canada. So many people living in such a great area are naturally different in many ways. If you have traveled around North America, or you have talked with people from different parts of the continent, then surely you have noticed that one of the biggest differences among people is the way they speak English. The most obvious differences are in people's pronunciation, but there are also some differences in grammar and many differences in vocabulary from region to region. In today's lecture, we are going to look at some interesting examples of all three types of differences, beginning with the pronunciation, or what you might call accent. Certain accents are easy to recognize because they contain features that are unique to a particular region of the continent. Let me give you three examples. You can almost always recognize English-speaking Canadians because they have a special way of pronouncing the sound that is usually spelt O-U. So, while people in the United States say out, about, and around, Canadians pronounce these words as out, about, and around. Can you hear the difference? Another accent that is fairly easy to identify is that of New York City. Many New Yorkers pronounce the ah sound almost as if it were spelled aw. Listen to the difference. Coffee, coffee. Dog, dog. Because. Some New Yorkers also add an R sound to many vowel sounds, such as law and order, pronouncing it lawr and order. New Yorkers also say idea instead of idea, and Africa instead of Africa. People from Boston, on the other hand, say aunt and half the way British do, but in most other places, people say aunt and half. Bostonians also drop most of their R's. Have you ever heard someone say he was going to park the car? This person was probably from the Boston area. Let's go on now to some differences in grammar. Actually, there isn't much variation in grammar from region to region. Some variation in spoken grammar, as in the use of the simple past tense, is acceptable. For example, in some areas it's normal for people to say, I catched a fish, instead of, I caught a fish. But I want to emphasize that we are dealing here with spoken grammar, since, as you know, written English is the same everywhere. It is what we call standard English. Finally, let's talk about some vocabulary differences. These are fun to examine. For example, when you go to the supermarket, what do you carry your groceries home in? In California, your answer would be a paper bag. In the eastern United States, you would call it a paper sack. But in the area of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, you would call it a poke. Another example, for dinner. Do you like to eat green beans, string beans, or snap beans? They are, in fact, the same thing, but each name is used in different geographical areas. As you can see, in North America, differences in the names of objects are determined by geography and not by social or economic class, as they are in some other countries. I want to say, in conclusion, that I have given you just a handful of examples of regional differences in pronunciation, grammar, and vocabulary in the United States and Canada. There are naturally hundreds of such differences. But in spite of these differences, North Americans do not have much trouble understanding one another, even if they come from places that are as far apart as, say, the northern part of Canada and South Texas. The linguistic differences are simply not great enough to interfere with our ability to communicate with one another.
Part 4. Functions of Language. Everyone knows what is supposed to happen when two Englishmen, who've never met before, come face to face in a railway compartment. They start talking about the weather. In some cases, this may simply be because they happen to find the subject interesting. Most people, though, are not particularly interested in analyses of climatic conditions. So there must be other reasons for conversations of this kind. One explanation is that it can often be quite embarrassing to be alone in the company of someone you are not acquainted with and not speak to them. If no conversation takes place, the atmosphere can become rather strained. However, by talking to the other person about some neutral topic, like the weather, it is possible to strike up a relationship with him without actually having to say very much. Railway compartment conversations of this kind, and they do happen, although not, of course, as often as the popular myth supposes, are a good example of the sort of important social function that is often fulfilled by language. Language is not simply a means of communicating information about the weather or any other subject. It is also a very important means of establishing and maintaining relationships with other people. Probably the most important thing about the conversation between our two Englishmen is not the words they are using, but the fact that they are talking at all. There's also a second explanation. It is quite possible that the first Englishman, probably subconsciously, would like to get to know certain things about the second. For instance, what sort of job he does and what social status he has. Without this kind of information, he will not be sure exactly how he should behave towards him. He can, of course, make intelligent guesses about his companion from the sort of clothes he is wearing and other visual clues, but he can hardly ask him direct questions about his social background, at least not at this stage of the relationship. What he can do, and any reasoning along these lines on his part is again usually subconscious, is to engage him in conversation. He's then likely to find out certain things about the other person quite easily. He will learn these things not so much from what the other man says as from how he says it. For whenever we speak, we cannot avoid giving our listeners clues about our origins and the sort of person we are. Our accent and our speech generally show what part of the country we come from and what sort of background we have. We may even give some indication of certain of our ideas and attitudes. And all this information can be used by the people we are speaking with to help them formulate an opinion about us. These two aspects of language behavior are very important from a social point of view. First, the function of language in establishing social relationship. And second, the role played by language in conveying information about the speaker. We shall concentrate for the moment on the second clue-bearing role. But it is clear that both these aspects of linguistic behavior are reflections of the fact that there is a close interrelationship between language and society.
Part 5. The Long Essay. You have experience with this age group in...
I have.
In Singapore or...
In Malaysia.
In other parts of Malaysia? Right. When you were teaching this age group, were they bilingual?
They were bilingual.
Were they in English medium schools?
English medium schools.
All right. Well, that's very useful experience, isn't it? Yes, and you were teaching English, were you?
Yes, English and other subjects. But they were in English.
Right. So you were like a form teacher.
Right.
Teaching the whole range of subjects. Well, that's a very, very useful background for this project, I think. But you've also got here short stories and poems for practicing phonetics.
Well, actually, what I intended was this communicative materials.
Mm-hmm.
You see, in the form of short stories.
Yes.
You see, and poems.
Yes, poems. You mean poems that have been published, that you...
No.
That you can use with them? You want them to write poems?
No, I mean through my poems, the poems that I'm going to write.
You're going to write poems? Oh, that sounds wonderful. What? Simple poems?
Simple poems, so that the children would find it, you know, like a sing-song.
I think what we need, actually, is a slightly more specific plan.
Right.
Than this one. Shall we see if we can make a plan? Using a topic-based approach, to the teaching of English as a second language, to 7, to 11-year-old bilingual children. So we can take that as the title. Then probably... Now, there are lots of different things here. You need some kind of section that discusses... Now, first of all, you want to talk about context, don't you? And you want, let's say, London and Malaysia, just to discuss what we said. Can the materials be universal? And then you want something on criteria... For designing these. Now, what... Let's just list the ones we've mentioned... Can we go through them? What have we got here? Motivation. So we're thinking of 7 to 11-year-olds. Motivation. What are the important ones, do you think? Multicultural, communicative, what else have we said? Cross-curricular. Those are the four main ones, aren't they? Oh, integrated skills.
Oh, yes.
Right, integrated skills. And when you're discussing those criteria... You can mention, you can bring in, relate it to poems, stories, and tasks that they do. And then you actually want your materials, so you need to choose a topic.
Materials topic?
Where you can put these together. And then you want to, after you've actually presented the materials, you want some detailed comments on different parts of them. How does that sound?
Very, very impressive. Very good.
Does that make sense to you, if we put it like that? So we've really taken all of those things and just slightly rearranged them, okay? I think that sounds very, very interesting. 1. What is the student's job?
2. In which country has the student been working?
3. What are the tutor and the student talking about?
4. Which of the following statements is true as regards the student?
5. How do these two people feel about the results of their discussion? Part 6. Listening and Translation. A. Sentence Translation.
1. My hotel is very short-staffed at the moment, and some of the guests have started complaining.
2. Tell the manager he'll have a real problem on his hands if I miss my flight because of this hotel's incompetence.
3. Some Asian economies now face the danger of overheating as labor and other costs rise, trade balances get worse, and inflation climbs.
4. World oil producers and consumers will meet in Venezuela this week for the 4th International Energy Conference.
5. A special unit to be called the Crime Prevention Bureau has been set up in this city to deal with computer crimes, the local police declared on Friday.
B. Passage Translation.
1. Let's make no mistake, we're dealing with a very dangerous man. He'll stop at nothing to get the information he wants, and he's not going to be easy to catch. He's a master of disguise. We've had reports of him dressed in black leather and riding a motorbike, looking like a very old man and even posing as a ski instructor. He's been seen in town in the last couple of weeks, and the latest reports tell us he's likely to be wearing a heavy overcoat with wide lapels and a collar which he often has turned up, even in fine weather. Another giveaway is the dark glasses he always wears.
2. I advise you to advertise in the newspapers that attract the right sort of readers. We need to look more closely at the consumers. As you can see, these newspapers attract older readers. 13% are aged between 45 and 54. Remember, old consumers have more money to spend than the younger ones. And look at this. 12% of the readers are in the A socioeconomic group. I suggest you concentrate your efforts on these weekly papers. There isn't much point in advertising in papers that attract the wrong groups.